شیشی راحت شد و خودم رو شیام کنده را این بگیری گوردان کی جای این دابندام کی جای دابدویب دام کی جای گنگا مای کی جای دیمون مای کی جای تلسی دیوی کی جای باکتی دیوی کی جای سام وید باکتی بند کی جای Shri Shri Radha Vrindavan Chandra Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Nitai Gaura Premanandi, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Sri Guru Sri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. As we're concluding the 26th chapter of the 12th chapter of the 6th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is Ritusura's glorious death, I would like to refer back to a previous chapter when Ritusura, in his previous life, was inspiring, encouraging, instructing Lord Indra to fight valiantly on the battlefield. Even though Indra was terrified to face this Ritusura, but hearing his words of encouragement and inspiration, he understood that this is Guru. Somehow my Guru has appeared in this most unusual manner to enlighten me. And the verses which Ritusura was speaking to Indra to encourage and inspire him to fight and to kill Ritusura, which seemed impossible considering his military Kshatriya prowess, it seemed that Indra was doomed. But Ritusura was encouraging, though even if success is impossible or inconceivable, you must perform your duty. And Ritusura was actually encouraging Indra to kill him. Because he knew that the Lord was arranging all the events in his life, from his 10 million barren wives, to the blessing of Angira Muni, which granted him a son, which paradoxically is named Harshashoka. He didn't catch the second half until later on. Then the son was poisoned by the envious co-wives. Then he was elevated to such an exalted spiritual status by the words of Narada that he attained darshan, the Lord Sankarshan. Traveled throughout the universe glorifying that Lord, whereafter he was inappropriately cursed by Parvati to take birth as a demon. But listen to the words of this demon, so-called demon, actually a great devotee, cursed in this way because the Lord wanted him to come home as soon as possible. And you see that theme expressed in the ardent yearning in his own words as they transmute from instructions of encouragement and inspiration to Indra to words of his own yearning expressed as prayer to the Lord So in the 26th verse of the 11th chapter, it's a very beautiful prayer. And this is on the battlefield. Because after his instructions to Indra, it's Asura, Asura in name only, great devotee. His mind naturally fixed on the lotus feet of the Lord, prays. O lotus-eyed Lord, as baby birds that have not yet developed their wings, always look for their mother to return and feed them, and as small calves tied with ropes await anxiously the time of milking, when they will be allowed to drink their mother's milk. Or as a morose wife whose husband is away from home always longs for him to return, I always yearn for the opportunity to render service unto you. And just a couple of verses previous to this, he is more specific, that he's yearning for the blessing of service to the servants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. A pure devotee always yearns to associate personally with the Lord and render service unto Him. The examples given in this regard are most appropriate. A small baby bird is practically never satisfied except when the mother bird comes to feed it. A small calf is not satisfied unless allowed to suck the milk from the mother's udder. And a chaste and devoted wife, whose husband is away from home, is never satisfied until she has the association of her beloved husband. These analogies used by Vidushana, the baby bird never satisfied till the mother returns to the nest, giving her shelter and feed to her offspring. A calf is never satisfied until the time of milking, when the calf gets some of the milk. And a devoted chaste wife is never satisfied until her husband returns. Are allegories, examples from practical daily life, which allude to something beyond themselves, the soul's eternal yearning for communion with the Lord. Another common example in theistic circles is the manner in which Krishna reciprocates his love with aspiring servants. As Krishna himself says, when I favor someone, I give him whatever he wants. But when my blessings really fall upon him, I take away everything. The analogy being that of a child and mother, that when a baby starts crying, the mother might give him some toys or some distractions or a bottle or so many things. Sometimes the baby will be pacified with whatever she gives. Sometimes the baby won't. You know, just keep on crying until the mother gives herself. This is another allegory. Because all the allegories of nature point to something beyond themselves. The soul's yearning for communion with the Lord. And the soul will never be satisfied with any of the trinkets offered by material nature. And when we continue in our devotion, in our focus for bhakti, then the Lord will ultimately give Himself. The soul, before any experience in any particular lifetime of interaction with material nature, or development of empiric knowledge, speaks from within, intuitive knowledge, which is spiritual. And if that intuitive knowledge is cultivated and not smothered or obliterated by empiric knowledge, then the soul will remain consistent in his search for Godhead. So before any experience of material interactions, before any accusation of empiric knowledge, the soul, as intuition, speaks from within the heart of man a consistent series of messages that I exist, I shall forever continue to exist. I have inherently joy. There is some great entity who is the source of my joy. My real nature is to depend upon the support of this great entity who is eternally guiding me and whose support is extraordinarily beautiful. I really have no power to abandon the support and the guidance of this supreme entity. But my present condition is lamentable because I have forgotten his love. And therefore, my prime duty in life is to return to my natural constitutional position of shelter of this supreme entity. Because this world is not my eternal residence. And by any progress in this world, my eternal advancement is not secured. So, unless and until one's reason honors this intuitive knowledge, he will just continue to wander and meander aimlessly through the endless labyrinths of material nature. And out of compassion, the Lord regularly appears in this world in each and every age, and he's continually in every age, in every culture, sending his representatives, sometimes coming himself, sometimes sending his representatives. And it's not true that the Lord only makes his appearance in Bharatvarsha. He makes his most regular and frequent appearances in Bharatvarsha because of his natural tendency to reciprocate with those who are inclined to follow his own given arrangement of Varnashram Dharma. But the Lord is equally inclined towards all of the entities. And therefore, he sends his representatives also in the West. So today, when we are coming together on this holiday, which used to mean Holy Day, and even though it's been very perverted, people are still more peaceful and joyful and kind and compassionate on certain holidays than they normally are. But Christmas is not actually the appearance day of Jesus, because nobody knows anymore his actual appearance day. Although the sages are unanimous in agreement that it was really in the spring. But this day was chosen because it was a pagan holiday. And pagans are not some demoniac people, they're just little incomplete in their knowledge, and they worship God in material nature, which is the first stage of the soul's development of some understanding of its relationship with this environment. The first stage of seeking relationship with Godhead is to try and relate to him in material nature, which is his nature, but it's separate. So, Christmas is actually a pagan holiday, but the early Christians were trying to make peace with the pagans, and they agreed to come together on this day utilizing the pagan holiday as an opportunity to celebrate the birth of Jesus, which actually took birth in the spring. If you consider the history of the different religions in the world in regards to the development of rasa, you can understand the similarity and basics between all the true religions of the world. The differences over which people are so inclined to fight are in regards to the details, the rituals, but the basic concepts are the same in all true religions. And those of you hailing from the East may be somewhat unfamiliar with the glorious life of Jesus. But Srila Prabhupada was not unfamiliar and repeatedly encouraged reverence for this great soul and saying that he's our guru. And this is not just encouraging rhetoric, this is reality. So if you look at the history of the world and its various religions and their development in terms of rasa, you see the interconnectedness between all religions and all true religious creatures. It all begins in the East with the unfolding of development of understanding of rasa in the consciousness of man, beginning in ancient times when the soul of man came to realize it could never find satisfaction by mere sacrifice of material objects. Those great souls who propounded the highest welfare for mankind, such as the exemplary case of the four Kumaras, abandoning all rituals based on material sacrifice, found refuge, eternal refuge, in the larger principle of the super soul. And severing all attachments to the material world, attained refuge in that consciousness called Shantaras. And whenever a realization of any particular rasa, which comes in sequence over the ages, dawns in the East, it gradually makes its way westward, like the rising of the sun, granting illumination in the East. Gradually, in the course of time, spreads its illumination, signifying knowledge, and energy, signifying life, force, to the West. So long after the four Kumaras attained that state of tranquility based on refuge in the Supersoul, that same realization dawned in the West, in the heart of one great soul named Abraham, who is known as the father of three faiths, but also himself personifies the faith of the four Kumaras, that of shelter and refuge in the eternal creator principle of the Supersoul. Thereafter, Dasyaras dawned in Bharatvarsha in the great servant of Ram, the monkey chieftain Hanuman. And the illumination which he bestowed upon the world, making its way westward, touched the heart of one creature in Southwest Arabia named Muhammad. Or rather, Moses, personification of Dasyaras amongst the Israelites. Arjuna followed with the privilege of serving friendship and preached it to the world. And that friendship with Godhead is what touched the heart of the preacher in Arabia, Muhammad. And Vatsalya Ras appeared at various times, in various ways, in various personalities in Bharatvarsha, most illustrious being Nanda Maharaj, in whose courtyard the Supreme Absolute Truth is playing like a little child. As the loving servant, child of Nanda. Nanda meaning the joy of spiritual communion. And that Vatsalya bhava, the serving friendship in familial context, where Godhead can either be son, which is preferable to Gaudiya Vaishnavas, or Godhead can be father. It's Vatsalya, either way. Father, son, familial context. That is the bhav, that is the rasa, which dawned in a little town called Nazareth, in the province of Galilee, in Jesus, the Savior of the Jews. Madhurya irradiated the realm of grudge, but really didn't, in its pure essence, go outside those precincts until Chaitanya Mahaprabhu began the mission of spreading it worldwide. And that Madhurya Ras, after a long time, finally reached the shores of the West in the humble heart of the most loving servant of the most merciful master, Srila Prabhupada, aboard the Jaladuta, the messenger of the waters coming from the east. So if you look at religious faith in terms of rasa, you'll understand that they're just developments through the ages of different degrees of realization of various degrees of intimacy, of love with Godhead. Shantaras, the realization of the continued existence of the soul in the shelter of the super soul, is mistaken as being some kind of bliss. But it's not really positive. It's really a negative type of bliss arising from cessation and destruction of material miseries and false identification, and a kind of tranquility of continued existence in the greater principle of the super soul. But as far as freedom, as far as intimacy, as far freedom really means to love. It's not really developed. It's only abstract in Shantaras. Real freedom, real love, begins with relationship. Rasa means the mellow flavor, the taste of a particular relationship with God. And however glorious a principle may be, unless it's seen as a person with which one has a specific relationship, one will have no special concern for the object of worship. And therefore, whatever apparent realization, yes, it's true realization, is incomplete. It's real bliss, but it's the negative. It's not the real positive awakening of rasa, of relationship, which dawns in dasyaras. But the greater principle is a person. He's my master, and I'm his servant. And with that relationship, something substantial is born in the consciousness of man. And love begins to grow with that realization. But there is the thorn, seen from a more complete perspective, in dasyaras, being that of distant reference, that he is the high and mighty controller of the world, and I'm just this little jiva who really can't get very close to him in the realm of intimate love. And therefore, however glorious Dasi Ras may be in comparison to Shanta Ras is quite incomparable to the jewel of confidentiality born in the servant who has the trust of the master and is therefore considered a friend, which translates as Vatsalya Ras, friendship, or rather Sakya Ras. And of all friends, the one who is most intimate, most loved, and the source of the greatest joy is a son. In familial context. And that is the bhava, that is the rasa, which Lord Jesus appeared to personify and convey to the Western world. And each rasa is perfect for one whose natural constitutional position is in that relationship with Godhead. But from an absolute perspective, there is higher and highest concepts. And each rasa, which is complete to each practitioner, is excelled by the following ones, which contain all the elements of the previous, but something more. So the something more contained in the Madhurya is that between even the most loving father and son, there are many things which must remain confidential, which will not be expressed. But not so between lovers. And therefore that Madhurya is the most complete rasa, which contains all the elements of all the previous ones, with something more in terms of intimacy of love with God. So the Lord cannot be apprehended or known or realized or interacted with by mere abandonment of material activities or meditation alone or together with sacrifice or renunciation. It can only be captivated by a rasa of the appropriate nature for each individual soul. So if we contemplate the history of the world in relationship to the appearance of rasa, we see how the different religions of the world developed. So, Abraham, who personified Shanta Ras in the West, gave birth to Isaac, in whose family came Jacob, whose 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. The first 11 being not so spiritually inclined, the 12th, the tribe of Levi, being the priestly order. And he also gave birth to another son, Ishmael, from whom came the Ishmaelites, or the Islamic faith. And in the house of Israel, after the demise of Moses, who freed the Israelites from captivity in Egypt, meaning physical bondage, and later escaping the bondage of Babylon, meaning emotional bondage, finally were led into the promised land. And then after that great leader Moses ascended to be with God, Joshua was the next great leader in that line. And after Joshua, the children of Israel were really bereft of a leader who could command the loyalty and respect and love that these previous great personalities had. So, Samuel, who was offered at the temple by his mother when he was just a baby and attained the privilege of service in the temple, rose to be a great prophet. And seeking a leader for the house of Israel, he was guided by the Lord to go to Jesse in the little town of Bethlehem. So going there, seeking Jesse and telling him he was on a message, a mission from Godhead to sacrifice and let us all join together in that sacrifice. And he asked to see the sons of Jesse, which the Lord had told him would contain the choice of the next leader of the house of Israel. So when Jesse brought out his eldest son, Samuel was very impressed by the young man's demeanor and countenance and prowess and qualities, and he was thinking this must be the chosen one. But the Lord told him, no, you look upon the outward appearance of man, but I, the Lord, look upon the heart. So he said, bring your next son. And Samuel was again very much impressed. But the Lord did not confirm. And the next son, the next son. Do you have any more sons? He said, well, there's another one. But he's the youngest and he's really inconsequential, so we didn't bring him. He's out herding the sheep. So he said, well, bring him. That son was David. And when he came before Samuel, Samuel understood. The confirmation came from his heart that this is the one. The little shepherd, just so eager that he had been called to come, wanting to be seen by this great prophet, was so eager and so devotional that Samuel took the horn, which was filled with oil, and anointed the boy. At which time David felt the presence of the Lord stirring within his heart. Thereafter, when the Israelites, now David at this time is still just a young child, when the Israelites had their battle lines drawn with the Philistines, and he was once again out herding the sheep, because shepherds, they don't have any caste. They're like the street sweepers in India. They have no caste. And they're just like nobody, socially speaking. And one preacher was telling about, you know, the humility and the freedom from ego that kind of goes with the shepherds and the sacrifice they perform for their flock. And after the sermon, one man came to the pastor and said, you forgot something. What's that? He said, well, you know, I'm a shepherd. And you got to remember that they stink because, you know, they're always carrying sheep. And out in the desert, there's a shortage of water. So they're really an outcast. So David, out herding the sheep, when the battle lines were drawn, was told by his father, go take some cheese and milk down to the chieftains and also to your brothers, which he did. And then he saw what was going on the battle scene, at the battlefront. The Israelites, who were great Kshatriyas since the Exodus from Egypt, and have the Lord as their patron deity, and are always victorious, were totally intimidated by the Philistines, who had this one humongous warrior, and then another one right behind him, whose shoulders were over the heads of any of the Israelite warriors. His name was Goliath. And he had such a huge sword, and such a huge body, and such a huge shield, that he had the Israelites completely intimidated. And then when, you know, here comes David with some cheese to hand out to his brothers and the chieftains, what are you doing on this battlefield? You left, just go back to the sheep. And then Goliath let out this roar, which just sent all the Israelite chieftains running. And his challenge was, don't even present your army before me. Just let one of you come so I can kill him. And if you think that anybody can kill me, then all the Philistines will be your slaves. But if I defeat you, then all the Israelites are my slaves. And having just come from slavery in Egypt, they didn't want to be slaves, but nobody could confront this Goliath. He was such a Herculean Kshatriya. And the Israelites were so intimidated. The most valiant leaders were so intimidated that David, what is wrong with you? Have you forgotten the faith of our forefathers? And that irritated them. Look, you know, what are you? Some witness to the battle? Let's go back to the sheep, they said. And then others were saying, well, yes, he's saying what we need to hear. And then it caught the attention of the king, Saul, who called David, do you have some strategy? And David, very, very faithfully, proclaimed that, I'm not afraid, I'm not intimidated, I will face this monster, Goliath. I think he can do it. And then David told him that he who protected me from the attack of that lion, the same person who protected me from the attack of that bear, will surely protect me from this Goliath. So Saul already had some faith in David because he was actually quite famous as a shepherd. And he had learned three things as a shepherd. He had learned how to sing and compose prayers which came as song. He played a harp and he composed his prayers into beautiful songs which became famous as the main context of the Psalms. And he learned how to use a sling, not a slingshot, but a sling. Because the herd of sheep was always being attacked by wolves and lions and bears and dacoits. Because sheep, or any flock, was a wealth in the desert. So a shepherd, it was a very dangerous task. So he learned how to protect himself. And barehanded, he'd already killed the lion and the bear. This was a child. But most of all, he had learned how to trust in the Lord. So Saul said, well, God be with you. And he ordered his own armor be placed on David. And when they put the king's armor on David, he said, I can't move in this, all this armor. I'm just a little agile shepherd boy. I can't deal with this armor. I'll be like a sitting duck. So, well, whatever you think. So he took it off, put back on his shepherd cloth, and took his sling with five stones from the stream, and walked out on the line between the armies, just with a sling in one hand and a stick in the other. And then Goliath realized that this was the answer to his challenge, and he was offended. You think I'm some kind of dog that you're going to chase away just with a stick? And David replied that your massive sword and shield and body is inconsequential in comparison to the glory and might of the holy name of the Lord who you defy. And that was all that Goliath needed to hear. He charged with this little shepherd boy in such a rage, with sword raised. And David said, I'm just going to chop off your head and give it to the vultures and beasts to feed upon. And then when Goliath attacked, David, with his little shepherd's sling, flung a rock that hit him in the forehead, right between the eyes, so hard that it knocked him over, knocked him down. David went, took Goliath's massive sword, and cut off his head and held it up for all to see. And the Philistines just ran into the wilderness in total fear, and the Israelites followed them. Now at that point, Jonathan, who is the son of Saul, became very, very dear, intimate friend of David. They became so close. But the problem was that Saul, who was a great leader in Kshatriya, and was whose glories were proclaimed by his people, was kind of eclipsed by the glory of David, which was becoming sung by all the population. And Saul tried to, you know, contain his jealousy, and Jonathan tried to act as an intermediary to moderate it, but it flared up from time to time. Thereafter, the Ark of the Covenant. That's a very interesting element of worship. Because when Moses was given the Ten Commandments by God, and he came down from the mountain and saw that while he was just up on the mountain communing with God, the Israelites had resumed their previous anartha of worshiping idols. And he was so furious in his rage. Because it was a great offense. While he was communing with God, his people had reverted back to idol worship. So he smashed the tablets. There again, went up Mount Sinai, and the communion was again given the Ten Commandments on two stone slabs, which were carried in the Ark of the Covenant, a big chest. And it's very interesting. It was carried by the priests of the Levite tribe. But the Ark of the Covenant, holding these two tablets on which the Ten Commandments of the Old Testament are engraved, big chest upon which stand two cherubims, which are angels, with their wings outstretched. And in the arch, over the ark, between their outstretched wings, lies the holiest of holies of the Israelites. Meaning that the Lord resides in the relationships between devoted souls. He resides in the hearts of all living entities, but he specifically reveals himself in relationships. Not so much the relationships between jivas and himself, but in the relationship between jivas and each other, in their mutual sharing of love and devotion to the Lord. That's where he really reveals himself in his divine nature. So in that ark of the wilderness, wandering in the wilderness, their tabernacle consisted of a big fence in which the Ark of the Covenant was considered the holy of holies. And then there was, you know, different altars for the burnt sacrifice and where the priests would prepare to go. And that the ark was actually fell into the hands of the Philistines. At which time they were so beleaguered with plagues and disasters that they wanted to get it back to the Israelites. So interesting how they did it. They made a cart which they hooked to two milk cows. Normally a cart is pulled by oxen, but they chose two milk cows. And those milk cows wandered back into the Israelite camp. And at that point, David was seeking a permanent place of worship for the Ark of the Covenant, which was just, you know, being carried throughout the wilderness and through different battlefronts and for ages. So he chose Jerusalem as his capital, where he would. And the people built him a huge palace just out of appreciation for his years of saintly dedication and guidance and leadership. But he wanted a temple to be built for the glory of the name of the Lord. But the Lord told him that because your life has been so filled with bloodshed, even though it was virtuous, you cannot build the temple. It will be built by your son Solomon. But David had the privilege of designing the temple and inspiring its being built by his son. And then when David was very old and his life was coming to a close, he was yearning for some water from that well in Bethlehem. But Bethlehem was being held in siege by strong garrisons of Philistine armies. But his servants heard, they just wanted to drink from that well. So they stealthily made their way to the well got some water for their beloved king, and fought their way valiantly back with that jug of water and gave it to David, and he poured it out as an offering to the Lord. Meaning that Krishna is captivated by a pouring out of the heart, giving what we consider most precious to ourselves, which is really a false ego, pouring it out to the Lord. He didn't touch that water. So, after the demise of David, his son Solomon built that great temple in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, in that obscure little town of Nazareth, there was a saying, what good could ever come from Nazareth? It's comparable on the worldwide scale to Moundsville, West Virginia. What good could ever come from Nazareth or Moundsville? But the Lord works in mysterious, wonderful ways. In that little town of Nazareth, in that obscure province of Galilee, was one very beautiful, gentle, chaste, sweet, lovely girl named Mary, who with her friends loved to sit in the synagogue and hear and watch the priests as they did their rituals and recited the Old Testament, which she learned most of by heart and was always reciting. And her favorite verse in the Old Testament was that foretelling of the coming Messiah who would deliver his people from their sins and make his throne in Jerusalem, the seat of David. Now, Mary was engaged to a carpenter, also from Nazareth, named Joseph, who was also a very simple, humble, and devoted soul. And one night, in Mary's room, the whole room was engulfed in brilliant effulgence, and she was scared. But then from that light, as her eyes adjusted, the angel Gabriel, who also arranged darshan for Muhammad with the Lord, and who always since then he's like the precursor to the darshan of Mary, Medjugorje or wherever. Mary is always preceded by angel Gabriel. So, she told him, he told her that you will bear a son. And by his influence, the earth will be covered with the glory of God, with knowledge of the glory of God, by his influence, just as the sea is continually covered with endless waves. Now this is because Mary, she's the internal energy of God who affects our communion with him. But she was a virgin. She was not to be married for quite some time to come. So she was fearful hearing that she was going to bear a son. And the angel said, "Fear not. The child born unto you will be known as the Son of God." And this was all very bewildering to this little girl. But she, in great faith, she said, "Whatever you have said, come true." And then Joseph found out that his fiancée was pregnant, apparently pregnant, even though a virgin, before anything had been revealed to him. So being such a humble, simple, gentle man, he thought he would just leave rather than, you know, face his public disgrace, because at that time, by Hebrew law, the punishment for adultery was the girl would be stoned to death in public. Very disgraceful. form of execution. So he thought he would just leave and nobody would know what happened, what went wrong. And then Gabriel appeared to him and said, no. This birth will be glorious because it's not your son, but the Son of God who will appear as your child and reign forever and ever from the throne of David. His kingdom will never end. So, thereafter, the Roman Empire, or the Roman Emperor, made a law that he was going to compile a census. Everybody in the kingdom had to return to their native habitat and register for the census. And that also included taxes. So while Mary was still pregnant, and very far along in the pregnancy, they had to travel to Bethlehem, the city of David, because Joseph hailed from the family of David. So he had to return to Bethlehem. So while Mary was just at the final stages of pregnancy, she had to ride on a donkey. You see the Mertis here of Joseph and Mary and baby Jesus and their donkey. Such a humble procession coming from Nazareth to Bethlehem to register for the census and the tax. And just when they arrived in Bethlehem, they found that the inn had no vacancy. And Joseph was pleading with the innkeeper, my wife is about to give birth. He said, well, there's room in the stable. Just like when Lord Nityananda came to Ramachandra Khan and wanted a place to stay. He said, not in my house, you can stay in the cowshed. Just see the humility of the Lord and His servants when they come to this world. No room in the house for you. You can go to the stable. So the child was born in a manger, in the stable, in the presence of cows and donkeys. And meanwhile, on the outskirts of the village, in the desert, on the sand dunes, were the shepherds huddled up in their cloths around the campfire because it got cold at night in the desert. And the desert sky is very beautiful, like dark velvet backdrop with stars sparkling and glittering. And then one star became so bright and engulfed the shepherds in that light. And then again, the angel appeared and told the shepherds that the Messiah, who had for so long been prophesied, has taken birth in Bethlehem. So how could we recognize him as the only newborn infant wearing swaddling clothes? So they rushed down onto the village. And they went to the stable. And there they found that very sweet, loving mother with her newborn child, very effulgent. But he would not cry when he opened his eyes. He was smiling benevolently upon all the residents of the stable, the cows, the donkeys, his parents, and the shepherds. And the shepherds were so enraptured with joy, they went to the inn, they told, have you seen who has taken birth in the stable? The Messiah has come. Get out of here, you stinky shepherds. So they went back into the desert, just so grateful and thankful at heart. Meanwhile, the three wise men from the east were following that brilliant star, just like with the appearance of Krishna, the star Rohini became extremely effulgent, more than any other star. The wise men from the east were following the star. And they came to the kingdom of heaven. They're not named because of, I'll tell you what they weren't named. They came to the kingdom of Herod, who is like the plenary portion of Kamsa. Or actually more
the theistically speaking Jarasandha. He knew about the prophecy that the Messiah was to be born in the house of Israel and overcome all the enemies. Well, he figured enemies meant the Romans, who were hated by the Israelites, and vice versa. And he was a Roman, or he worked for the Romans. So he had his spies all throughout the kingdom, because he knew of the prophecy, but he didn't know when. So he had his spies, you know, smelling out any conspiracy or any plot that might be. And then he heard about the three wise men. So he called them into his court and said, "You're going to worship the Messiah? I also want to worship him. So let me follow, so I can find where he's taken birth." And they said, "Well, we don't really know. We're just following the star. So when you find him, we'll let you know." And then they continued, and they offered their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the child. From where comes the custom of giving gifts at the time of Christmas? But then the Lord told them, "You better take another road back to the east, because you don't want to get interrogated by Herod again." So they kind of disappeared from the scene. Meanwhile, Herod came to know from his high priest that the child had indeed taken birth in Bethlehem. So he sent his military to slaughter every child less than 2 years old. And therefore, the Lord told Joseph to flee back into Egypt. And after some time there, he told him, "Okay, you can go back to Nazareth," which was ruled by one of Herod's sons, who was not quite as ambitious as his father. So the child grew in Nazareth. And when he was about 11 or 12 years old, they again took a ride on the donkey to Jerusalem for the feast of the Passover. And they came to the temple of David. And there was one old sotto named Simeon, who had spent his life in great earnest awaiting, because he knew that in his lifetime the Messiah was going to come to the Temple of David. It's usually called the Temple of Solomon. It was inspired and designed by David. So when Simeon saw Mary riding on the donkey with her child, he ran and picked up the boy and embraced him, and his whole frame became so thrilled with ecstasy. And the ecstatic symptoms became very prominent on this Simeon. And Mary was so astonished, "What is going on?" And he said, he said to the boy, now your servant can depart in peace. And then he looked at Mary and said, "This child will be the cause for the rise and fall of many in Jerusalem, because he will bring out what is in the heart of man." She had no idea what any of this meant. And then Simeon's ecstasy took a turn and became very grave. And almost choked up, he told Mary. She didn't quite register what he said, but a sword in the future will pierce your heart. So, thereafter, for 30 years, Jesus was not preaching, because following the custom of the Vaishnavas, because Christianity is Vaishnava, remember, it's Vaishnava in Vatsalya, Bhava. And what goes in the name of Christian today, you cannot take as being representative of the actual cult. And the true Christians who
live today do not like to be identified with the masses who proclaim the Christian faith, but do not do it justice. So Jesus, in consistency with the Vaishnava teachings, in honoring the custom, Lord Chaitanya did not preach until after his initiation from Ishwarapuri. Honoring the custom of not excelling the superior, of taking the blessings, the instructions of Guru as one's life and soul before trying to present the absolute. Now, at the same time that Mary conceived, she was informed by Gabriel also that your cousin, Elizabeth, also at this time, although a very old lady who had never had a child, very old lady, way beyond childbearing age, but Gabriel told Mary that your cousin Elizabeth will also bear a child at this time. So go see her and rejoice together. She went to see Elizabeth. And Elizabeth told her, I'm pregnant, even like in her 70s, without ever having a child in her life. So, when Jesus was 30, the son of Elizabeth was also 30 years of age, and had come to the River Jordan and became very famous as a prophet, John the Baptist. And Jesus went to the Jordan, and John proclaimed, "This is the Lamb of God." See, the analogy, the allegory of the shepherd is a very consistent theme throughout Christianity, and Jesus himself presented himself as the good shepherd who would even give his life for any one of the flock. So, when John the Baptist proclaimed, "This is the Messiah," Jesus very humbly proclaimed that, "I have come to be purified by baptism from you." And John, just like when Mahaprabhu went to take Diksha for his sannyas from Keshava Bharati, he said, "Can you give me that mantra?" Keshava Bharati didn't know the Vaishnava sannyas mantra. Mahaprabhu whispered it into his ear, and Keshava Bharati gave it back. So Mahaprabhu first initiated Keshava Bharati, who in turn initiated Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So similarly, John said, "I should be taking shelter of you. You should be baptizing me." He said, "No, you are John the Baptist. I've come to be purified. I can't have you here." So as a duty, as a humble duty, John the Baptist baptized Jesus. Thereupon, he began his preaching, which is very largely based on the parables. And later, in the Sermon on the Mount, beginning with the Beatitudes, each verse beginning, "Blessed are those who," starting with, "are humble, they shall be considered children of God." And then throughout, going through all the progressions of bhakti, in the first part of the verse, "Blessed are," and the second part, qualification, culminating with, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for their future is sure in the kingdom of God." So, by the power and glory of humility in the servant, the master's heart goes out to the servant. So Shraddha is that which awakens connection with what is higher than any calculation of our own. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was a great astronomer. He would make so many elaborate astronomical, astrological, his calculations, which are very accurate. He was a world-renowned astrologer. Present his calculations to Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Sometimes he would accept, and sometimes, no, this is not coinciding with the will of the Lord. So, in the crossing of the great ocean of nations between our residence here and our actual homeland, there are so many great dangers and traumas to be faced. And our faith is the essential affair which keeps the heart ever hopeful, ever yearning, ever enlivened by the guidance of the sadhus and the gurus who are like guiding stars in our light, which guiding stars chalking out our course, which we would otherwise be lost in the vast expanse of that ocean. The Lord is repeatedly sending his representatives, coming himself in every age and every culture, teaching, speaking to people in ways that they can understand. So, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who masterminded the preaching movement to go west, explained what should be the proper attitude of a servant of God when he comes to the place of worship of another faith. He said, when we go to the place of worship of those of another faith, we should be appreciative that these people are worshiping my Lord in their way. And that can inspire me and teach me so many things by which I can enhance my service to my Lord. So, on this day, which was chosen to celebrate the appearance of Jesus, even though not astrologically accurate, those from the East can appreciate the bhakti of those in the West, and those in the West can appreciate the bhakti of those in the East. And most of all, we can appreciate and practice the words of Sri Krishna, Aham sarvasya bhavava mata sarvam pravartate iti mata vadanti mam buddha bhava samanmataha. When we understand that Krishna is the root of all sacrifices and austerities, the seed-giving father of all living entities, and most of all, the best well-wishing friend of all living entities, we can attain peace from the pangs of eternal nature. When the angel appeared to the shepherds in the desert, he said, by his appearance, let there be peace on earth and goodwill to men. So this brings us back to the root. Aham sarvasya bhavavo anta sarvam pravartate iti mata vadanti mam buddha bhava samanmataha. Krishna is the root. But he sends his representatives in every age, in every culture, to speak and teach just what the people can understand at that time. So we should not consider that one is lesser because he's teaching introductory course. That's all the people could understand considering where they were coming from. And this is all part of a grand plan leading up to Srila Prabhupada's coming with the most complete intimate knowledge of the soul's potential relationship with God. So, in our glorification and appreciation and dedication and service to Srila Prabhupada, we should also appreciate all those who preceded him, paving the way for this illustrious messenger, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to take root in Western soil. This is part of a long history over the ages and cultures in preparation for the humble arrival of the Jaladuta on the shores of the empire of Maya and illusion and greed. Thank you very much. How glorious is Srila Prabhupada. Are there any questions or comments? Hare Krishna.